It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, find out what's at stake in negotiations over the federal debt limit and what happens if Republicans and Democrats don't reach an agreement. First, soccer might not be the first sport that comes to mind when you think about Wisconsin, but the game is gaining popularity in the state with major expansions in the works. Madison's lower-level professional men's soccer team, Forward Madison FC, led its league in attendance in 2022. And earlier this month, the team announced plans to bring the first professional women's soccer team to Wisconsin starting in the fall of 2024. Two of the founders of Forward Madison also announced plans last fall to build a new sports and entertainment district in Milwaukee that will host a new professional men's soccer team starting in 2025. And last summer, Lambeau Field in Green Bay hosted its first ever soccer game with a high-profile exhibition matchup between a top German team, Bayern Munich, and a top British team, Manchester City. It's an exciting time for soccer fans in Wisconsin and a good time to get into the sport if you thought about giving it a try. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a soccer fan or curious about the game? What do you think about the growth of professional soccer here in Wisconsin? Do you want to see it come to your neck of the woods? Have you been to a professional game? What was the experience like? Do you play at any level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Connor Kaloya is the chief operating officer of Big Top Sports and Entertainment. He's one of the founders of Forward Madison FC and the former Green Bay Voyageurs soccer team. He's going to be the COO for the new professional women's team in Madison and the new professional men's team in Milwaukee. Connor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
Let's start with some of the newest news here, the announcement of the first professional women's soccer team here in Wisconsin. What can you tell us about the plans?
Yeah, you know, we have secured a franchise for a first division, so the top division of professional soccer in the U.S. So we've secured a franchise for our first division women's club that could start play here in Madison as soon as 2025. Now, we have a clear path to bring the franchise here. With that being said, our great facility, Breeze Stevens Field, needs some renovations and improvements to get up to the standard of a first division professional soccer club. We need a new turf on the field, some additional seating, and then the proper infrastructure for women-specific locker rooms and kind of back-of-house needs. And if we can work with the city of Madison to make those improvements to the facility, we'll be bringing women's professional soccer here to Madison.
And this is something you've thought about for a while. You've said elsewhere that Forward Madison could have started a women's soccer team already at an amateur level. You had wanted to wait, though, to make sure it was a fully professional team. Why was that important?
Yeah, you know, since we launched Forward Madison, so we announced Forward Madison in 2018. We started playing in 2019. At that time, we hoped within 3 to 5 years, we'd be able to secure a women's franchise for Madison as well. And it was actually 5 years and one day that it took us to secure a women's franchise. You know, everything we've done with Forward Madison, we work with our supporters, our great fans, our season ticket holders. They're the lifeblood of the club. They direct the decision-making of the club. And since the start, you know, with Forward Madison, they picked our team colors. They picked our team name. They even picked the logo that we use. And as we've explored women's soccer, especially over the last 3 years, we've regularly convened focus groups with our supporters group to guide us on what we should be doing. And in talking to the supporters group, you know, there was a league that existed that was an amateur league. We had the opportunity to join that league on the women's side, and our supporters felt strongly that it just didn't feel right that you would have a paid men's team and an unpaid women's team. And they didn't think that told the right story from an equity standpoint. And so we have kind of stepped back and encouraged the league to start a professional product. And here we are a few years later. There's a professional women's league, and we're excited to have secured a franchise. And hopefully bring a first division women's league team to the stadium where a third division men's team is playing.
Talking to Connor Kaloya with Big Top Sports and Entertainment, looking at pro soccer here in Wisconsin, what's happening now, and a couple teams in the works over the next couple of years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Current soccer fans, love to hear from you about your thoughts on these teams opening up here in the state. If you have questions about what goes into creating a soccer team, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Connor, before we head on over to these plans for Milwaukee another year down the road, just want to get your thoughts on the popularity of soccer here in Wisconsin? What are you seeing in terms of hunger for teams in the state?
Yeah, you know, the way that our announcement last week has been received has just been overwhelming, overwhelmingly positive. You know, there's 51,000 youth players across the state under the age of 35. Americans consume soccer at the same rate they consume baseball and basketball. 10 years ago, there was about 45 professional teams, outdoor professional teams in the U.S. Now there's more than 120. So there's just been rapid growth over the last 10 years. We expect that growth to continue. I think what's happened with Forward Madison here in Madison has exceeded what our expectations were when we launched this club. And we're seeing great demand and interest in both our future Milwaukee club, but also the Madison women's professional soccer team. With the World Cup coming to North America in 2026, we think there's only going to be an increased interest in outdoor spectator soccer. And we think over the next 20 years, that interest will continue to grow. So we're excited to continue to invest in the space and do more to bring more soccer to the fans of Wisconsin.
I want to expand on something you mentioned there. How much of increasing interest in soccer in the U.S. is coming from, you know, those kids playing it and their parents? I'll speak from personal experience. I didn't know from soccer growing up, really. My kids played it from kindergarten through, well, still into college now. And I'm, you know, not the hardest core fan, but I certainly appreciate the game a lot more. Is my story a pretty common one?
Totally is. Yeah. And you know, our core demographic with soccer, soccer is a little bit more of a, what I would say, like a lifestyle sport than it is kind of your traditional mainstream sports. And our core demographic at Forward Madison, it's a very diverse group of 25 to 35 year olds. And if we're connecting with that group, then their parents and adults think it's cool. And as long as we maintain a family friendly product, we'll continue to connect with the youth soccer players and their parents. And so you're absolutely right. As I mentioned, 51,000 youth players across the state. A lot of parents or parents with young kids have had kids play soccer. That's connected them to the game. And once they're watching their kids play, then they might pick up a Major League Soccer game on TV or an English Premier League game, and then, you know, check out their local professional team like Forward Madison. So there's absolutely been rapid growth at the youth level. It continues to grow. And just soccer is so much more accessible, especially at the younger ages, whether it be from a video game standpoint, from watching English Premier League or Major League Soccer. When we were growing up, or, you know, when I was growing up, soccer was not nearly as accessible it is now. So that's a big part of it.
Now let's go to Milwaukee. This plan is a little further out. Can you tell us about a new men's professional team in the works there? It'll be at a higher league level than the one that's currently in Madison. Tell us your hopes for that one.
Yeah, we secured a franchise in the USL Championship. So it's the second division of American soccer, mainly markets of a million plus teams, 26 markets across the U.S. And we've, you know, acquired a 12-acre parcel of land in the Westtown District at 6th in Michigan. And we have plans to build an 8,000-seat soccer stadium, a 200-key hotel, and about 170 workforce multifamily housing units. Retail and entertainment space. So it's a comprehensive development. We've already started demolition on the site. The housing element of the site has started, and we're hopeful that we can be up and playing soccer there as soon as 2025. It'd be the highest level of men's professional soccer in the state. It would be the home of Marquette's men's and women's soccer and lacrosse teams. And it would really be kind of an outdoor community venue to bring together many different entertainment uses. And something, you know, if you look across the country, you look at the largest markets without professional soccer, Milwaukee is one of the top five markets in the U.S. that doesn't have a high level professional soccer team.
Now, I mentioned that Green Bay team. It was at a league lower than the Madison one. It only lasted a few years. Is there something about, you know, a place like Madison not having a lot of competition in the pro sports world in general? Whereas in Green Bay, you know, there's another sport that kind of overshadows everything else there. Milwaukee, you've got a couple established teams in major leagues. Is that kind of other sport competition, does that make it harder for a pro soccer team to stand out?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think Green Bay, that team, it was an amateur team. The season ran from mid-May to July, and it was really, the pandemic made that business model really challenging. And coming out of the pandemic, After a short run there, you know, we kind of just decided to focus on our professional soccer operations. We think pro teams in the state are a more viable option. While there is a lot of competition in Milwaukee, we think there's a massive void in the market as it relates to soccer. You know, we had nearly 5,000 people submit names for the team. I think yesterday we started to put up different possibilities of what we would call the team and our name the team contest. We had over 10,000 votes in the first day. So there's amazing engagement. I think there's a pent-up demand in Milwaukee to have professional soccer. Actually, in 2014, a supporters group started with the sole focus of trying to bring pro soccer to Milwaukee. That was the Milwaukee Barons. At one time, I think they surpassed over 5,000 Facebook followers. So there's a lot of interest in the market. We think it'll be a great place to have professional soccer. And while there is competition, we think the interest will allow us to kind of step into that space and have some success.
We're talking to Forward Madison FC Chief Operating Officer Connor Kaloya about the growth of professional soccer in Wisconsin and the response from fans and communities in the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see soccer getting more interest in your community, maybe in your own family? Did you inherit a love of soccer from your kids at some point along the way, as I did? Have you been to a professional soccer match, MLS, something overseas, or a local team? Call it and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Connor Kaloya, COO of the soccer team Forward Madison FC. He'll hold the same position for new professional teams, two new teams coming to Wisconsin, most likely over the next couple of years, a women's team in Madison at the top level of women's play, and a men's team in Milwaukee, one level below the top there. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. No soccer fans out there today? Have you been to a game? Have you played yourself? Are you excited at a possible growth in professional soccer options here in the state? Women's teams, men's teams, join in with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Connor, how important was Forward Madison and its attendance levels to the impetus to bring in these other teams in the state? How much of it was a test case for bringing in these other teams?
Yeah, so it was the first professional team, outdoor professional team, in 20 years here in the state. And I think that the way the community connected with the team went beyond what we expected. And we've shipped merchandise to 50 states, 32 countries. That's far beyond what we ever expected when we created this club with the help of the community. When we launched Madison at that time, we had contemplated kind of a statewide strategy for spectator soccer. So, Milwaukee was kind of on our minds. But after that first season in Madison, keep in mind that was pre-pandemic, but in 2019, after that first season, that really kind of made us confident to, move forward with a club in Milwaukee, but also push harder to bring a women's professional team here to Madison. So, it's been a great test case. And I think what we've only seen and what we're only seeing across, locally and across the country is an increased interest and growth in pro soccer.
I'm getting ahead of the game here with the women's team. It is a top level team. If there are soccer celebrities in the United States, it's the U.S. Women's team with a lot of World Cups under their belt. Is there a hope, a dream that some of those star players might end up on a Wisconsin team?
Yeah, we're a few years away, but I do think, there's a significant difference on the men's side versus the women's side. While soccer is very good in the U.S., the men's U.S. national team may be, top 16 in the world regularly. The U.S. women's national team is the top, or hopefully is the favorite to win the Women's World Cup this summer. And so the best women's soccer players in the world come from the U.S. And so, yeah, the hope would be that at some time in the near future or in the early years of the club, we would be able to have, a women's national team player on the roster. We'll be playing at the first division. we're going to work to build this club in a way that it'll be competitive at the first division. And it would be great to have some women that play at the highest level on the club.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just heard you, put your shout out for people to call in, and I just had to call in because I have to represent. There can't be no callers for the fans of soccer. I just wanted to give our little story that I'm a mom of two kids, both of whom played soccer in high school. My son's actually a player on his team now. He's the goalie. His older sister was on a pretty successful high school team here in Wisconsin, and it started because her dad had a cousin who played soccer professionally in another country, and I just really wanted to steer my kids. I didn't want to spend, frankly, the whole winter sitting in a basketball court, so there's a little selfishness to it, but I love soccer, and I wish it had been around when I was a kid.
And Laura, has that translated into you and your family going to see games, doing soccer tourism to take in pro games?
My daughter and her boyfriend and my husband went to see the first professional soccer game that was held at Lambeau Field. I think it was just this last winter, was it?
Yep. And how about that weather?
That was a big deal. Yeah, they really enjoyed it.
Laura, thanks so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Connor, I think you're probably hoping there are a lot of fans out there like Laura and her family.
We hope there's more than one fan. Yeah, Rob, that is the hope. But no, you hit on the point earlier that absolutely a lot of people are connecting with the game through their kids. When we were growing up, or people of our generation, I have a 6 and a 9-year-old, I'm in my early 40s, you played soccer, but there wasn't the opportunity to consume soccer like there is now. And Laura mentioned the Lambeau Field match, and that's a great testament to the desire and interest in soccer in the state, a sold out Lambeau Field for the first professional soccer match ever played there.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura. Willem joins us now in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I remember I'm an immigrant to this country. I came with my parents in the late 1950s, early 60s, and my dad used to play semi-pro soccer in the Netherlands, and he started a team in Holland, Michigan, called the Holland Hotspurs, because his favorite team was the Tottenham Hotspurs. So they would play teams from Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo, Battle Creek. I can't remember the name of the league, but there were mostly foreign immigrant players from Germany and Czechoslovakia. There was a guy from Pakistan. Anyway, so that was interesting, but there was nothing, happening in American soccer. And when I was a child, they used to play soccer in grade school, everyone would just gather around the ball and kick at it, and that's not how you play the game.
Willem, thanks a lot for sharing that. So some predecessors here, kind of, I want to know more about that league that Willem's dad played in, but can you talk about immigrants bringing attention to the game here in Wisconsin and beyond?
Yeah, so, in the 1950s and 60s, Milwaukee was one of the best soccer markets in the entire U.S. And Milwaukee, Cincinnati, St. Louis, those are kind of the premier soccer markets. And a lot of that is because a lot of immigrants played with their teams, whether it be the Croatian Eagles or the Serbian teams, the Bavarians. If you look now, this is 60 years later, but those markets that were really good soccer markets in the 1950s and 60s, driven by immigrant populations, now are great professional markets. Cincinnati and St. Louis have new stadiums and have amazingly successful major league soccer teams. So, Milwaukee and Wisconsin as a whole has always been a very good soccer state. It's been underserved from a spectator soccer standpoint. We've started to fill that void here in Madison, and are excited to fill that void in Milwaukee.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Willem. Teresa joins us now in Madison. Teresa, hi.
Hello. Obviously, I come from England. Chelsea, I support entirely. Been to the FA Cup twice. Somebody mentioned the Lambeau Field game. That was a bloody disgrace. They both put on their second teams, and you're paying a fortune. On to the soccer. My daughter was a brilliant player, played for the top teams in Madison. You get to a certain age, and then those girls are just like fodder. They're just traded from one to the other. I travelled all over with a baby. I supported her entirely. But at the end of the day, I didn't want to sacrifice, you know, how she was going to do mentally being treated like that.
Teresa, thanks for the call. I thought there were a lot of starters at that Lambo game, but point taken. But Teresa, wondering what's happening at these higher levels for girls in the sport. Connor, do you have thoughts on what's happening at the higher end of the youth leagues?
Yeah, I think Teresa brings up a valid point there. And we're, you know, couple points or couple thoughts on that. First of all, from a women's professional standpoint, you know, there's 101 men's professional teams in the U.S. There's 12 women's professional teams. That's just amazingly inequitable. And there's a lot of great women's professional or women's soccer players that aren't getting the chance to play professionally. One unique thing about our kind of league is we will have an academy product that allows girls from ages 13 and up to play. We'll likely eventually have an amateur product that connects with college age women, and then also a pro product. So we will create a pipeline. I do get Teresa's point that youth soccer, and especially at the competitive level, can be, can be a lot. And I think that is something, you know, we're not in the youth space, we're in the professional space, but something we do try and work with the 41 area youth clubs here in the Madison Area Youth Soccer Association. And we'll be working with the Milwaukee clubs as well to kind of make sure that we're all working together to develop a sustainable and great game together.
Teresa, thanks for that call. And my daughter is also a Chelsea supporter. Connor, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Connor Kaloya, Chief Operating Officer of Big Top Sports and Entertainment, where he founded and now operates the Forward Madison FC soccer team. With us today to talk about the growth of pro soccer in the state, with plans announced for a new women's team in Madison and a men's team in Milwaukee. Coming up after the news, could the federal government default on its debts? We'll look at the fast approaching federal debt limit. What to expect if an agreement can't be reached in time. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we've got a collection of the best graduation advice for high school and college grads, and you could share your suggestions. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has repeatedly warned lawmakers that the U.S. could be unable to pay its bills and default on its debt, possibly as early as next Thursday. After President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met on Monday, both expressed some optimism that a deal could be reached to raise the debt ceiling and avoid an unprecedented default. McCarthy talked to the media earlier today.
Now we have the highest debt at any time to American history. So I just think it's common sense, it's reasonable, and it's rational that we spend less next year than we spend this year. Every household would do this.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responded at today's White House press briefing.
During President Biden's first 2 years in office, he cut the deficit by $1.7 trillion. Now, folks, that's a record. And in March, he released a plan that would reduce the deficit by another nearly $3 trillion over 10 years.
The Biden administration wants to close tax loopholes and raise taxes on billionaires and has offered to freeze federal spending at current levels. Speaker McCarthy says a spending freeze doesn't go far enough. What would it mean if the U.S. hit the debt ceiling? It's uncharted territory, and you could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What should a deal on the debt ceiling look like? Or hang on, should there be a deal on the debt ceiling, or should it just be passed and talk about spending cuts later? What questions do you have about how we got here and what it would mean if we enter this default? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's nice to be back.
All right, let's talk about the stakes here. First of all, if we end up at this point, Congress doesn't vote to increase the debt ceiling and next Thursday apparently comes along, what starts happening then?
So we don't necessarily know. You know, the debt ceiling is something of an artificial cap, right? There's a law on the books from 1917 that places a nominal cap on how much debt the United States government can issue. And that's the sort of thing that has been raised dozens of times over the years as we hit the cap, because the economy grows, the population grows, the size of government gets bigger. In the last decade or so, it's become much more politically controversial with political polarization, and it's been used in this sort of, you know, high stakes negotiation linked to the budget. But we don't really know, right? On some bigger picture level, the United States government, as issuer of the dollar in the global economy, has no trouble borrowing and issuing its debt. It's just a law that says we can't issue more debt. But Congress has already authorized a level of spending. Mm. So we're in this weird position where the president is now put in a position of, do I honor the laws that have been passed that say we should, you know, send money out the door to pay the bills of the United States government, or do I honor this other law which says we can't issue any more debt?
Right. If it's that latter, and we can't pay everything we owe, the U.S. federal government, I mean, I've seen some nightmare scenarios. We're defaulting on debt, collapse of the international financial system, list goes on, or bits and pieces. Okay, maybe Social Security recipients don't get all the money that they get. What are some of the different options there?
It's not a sort of instant cliff, right? Mm. So the Treasury Department would have to start prioritizing which bills do we pay first and whatnot, buying and selling securities and things like that. There's a couple things on the table which have been dismissed by both parties as sort of gimmicks, which the government could possibly do, right? So there's another law which gives the Treasury Secretary control over coinage in the United States in any denomination they want. And so according to that law, the U.S. Treasury could mint a platinum coin, give that to the Federal Reserve, which deposits it in the Treasury's account, and suddenly we would have $1 trillion to pay our bills.
It seems kind of like a silly way around it, and maybe an inflationary way around it. I don't know.
It's silly in that it's sort of gimmicky, but it is, according to the letter of the law, it is legal, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing that could happen is the debt limit applies only to the principal of U.S. government bonds. Right, so there are different denominations of bonds and, you know, amounts and interest rates. So there's a type of bond called perpetual bonds where the U.S. government could issue bonds and say, we're never going to pay off the principal, but we're only going to pay the interest. And if people bought those sorts of bonds, suddenly the U.S. government would be able to finance its debt indefinitely as well. That's another thing which sounds gimmicky, but according to the letter of the law, is legal. And then we have the constitutional option, which is the 14th Amendment. That people have been talking about. The Section 4 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution says that the validity of the public debt of the United States shouldn't be questioned, right? And this was passed at the end of the Civil War, during times when people were worried about, you know, the North and the South fighting afterwards about whether Confederate debt should be honored, whether Union pensions should be paid, and things like that. So it's also possible that President Biden could say, the 14th Amendment obligates me to ignore the debt ceiling. And then we would have a legal fight that would go towards the Supreme Court. But regardless of what's going to happen, it's not going to be suddenly next Thursday the U.S. is going to default on all of its debt and we're going to have a global financial crisis.
Mm-hmm. Now, the idea of negotiating over the debt ceiling, President Biden had started this process saying we shouldn't negotiate over the debt ceiling. It is a must-pass thing. We could talk about our budget later. Right. The argument from Republicans now and some others is, okay, if we take the idea of reducing the annual deficit, slowing the growth of the debt as a good thing, this is the only time, this is the only leverage there is out there to make concrete cuts. If we leave it for the normal budget process, which doesn't exactly exist anymore, we're never going to do it.
Right. Yeah. And both parties over the years have used this for some leverage and linking it to budget concessions and things like that. It's really new in the degree to which the Republican Party really seems to be threatening actually going through with default. So on the one hand, you can say we're not going to negotiate. On the other hand, if President Biden is not going to negotiate and there's not a deal, again, he's going to be faced with this choice of doing one of these other things to prevent default, you know, which gets either into legal constitutional debates or involves some of these other gimmicks, or there's actually going to be a default. Right. So it seems unlikely to me that the White House is going to allow a default to happen. It's not clear, given how far apart the parties seem to be, that there's actually a negotiable agreement that's going to pass both the House and the Senate. So we are in somewhat uncharted territory in that people are realistically discussing some of these other things that are kind of more gimmicky and different than in past debt ceiling negotiations.
Talking to Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, looking at the debt ceiling, what is happening with that, negotiations on and off in Washington now, what happens if a deal isn't reached? Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Greg is with us in Lake Geneva. Greg, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
So my question is, if there's a default and other people lose services, our Social Security, the veteran benefits, blah, 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 are these politicians still going to be getting paid? Do their paychecks stop? Do their benefits stop? Or do they have nothing on the table?
That's a good question. And again, the federal government has lots of bills to pay, and there would be some decisions about the order in which those bills would be paid. But again, to the caller's question, right, I think it's very unlikely that what's going to happen is President Biden is going to say Social Security checks aren't going to go out the door and federal employees are not going to be paid. So to me, it's really a question of which of these options, which are more or less politically popular as ways to make sure we don't have the default, actually pan out. I think, you know, it seems an extremely low probability event to me that we get to the point where the government is not actually sending out things like Social Security checks and funding Medicare and whatnot.
Greg, thanks for that call. That said, if we are in this position, somebody who expects to be paid by the federal government won't be. Who decides that? And if I'm that party, whatever it is, am I going to go to court and say, hey, put me in the front of the line?
Right. Again, it's a question of how long this drags on, mm-hmm. right? It's not suddenly people are not going to be paid in, you know, the first 24 or 48 hours. If we really got to a point weeks from now where the government really said, all right, we're defaulting on our debt, There might be rushes to the courthouse with U.S. government bondholders. You know, there'd probably be a lot of protests if we were talking about the things the caller asked about with Social Security or Medicare. But again, I think what we would see is action by the White House to make sure that the government is able to serve its obligations. And then the legal fights about this would actually be about the constitutionality of something like minting the coin or something like invoking the 14th Amendment, not legal fights about whether people were actually going to get paid.
Thanks for that call. Joni is with us now in Eau Claire. Joni, hello.
Hello there.
Hi, what did you want to ask
How are
about?
You? Have some concern about, okay, in the prior administration, there was cuts for the billionaires, the extremely wealthy, and why, I guess I have to say the Republicans are really fighting, you know, raising the tax on billionaires when they were given cuts before, you know, what is the deal there? What is behind that other than political reasons? I mean,
I gotcha, Joni. Thanks for the call. And people have pointed toward the Trump era tax cuts, and people have also gone back to the George W. Bush era tax cuts, temporary, that you don't, they don't, they didn't take them back away. They don't seem to be on the table for Republicans, as Joni says.
Right. Yeah. So look, both parties, when they are in power, tend not to be very concerned about debt levels and deficits. Mm-hmm. And when they are in opposition, tend to state that they are much more concerned about debt and deficits. So that's more pronounced, I think, in the current episode, because the last times the Republicans had unified control, you had the big, the TCJA tax cuts in 2017. And so one possibility mathematically to solve this problem is to let those tax cuts expire. That's obviously off the table for political reasons. And again, as a political scientist, I look at this less as sort of, you know, how sincere is everybody about their concerns about being fiscal hawks and concerned about debt and deficits, and what are the political incentives here? And so the political incentives for the Republican Party right now, as you said, are to use this moment as leverage to get things that are effectively budgetary policies and involving spending cuts, which are their political priorities. And obviously retaining the tax cuts and making sure that the cuts are going to come on spending is a top political priority. The other thing that McCarthy and the Republicans have said is that all of the spending cuts are going to come from non-defense discretionary spending. Right, so Social Security cuts are off the table, Medicare cuts off the table, and defense spending off of the table. That is the lion's share of the federal budget. Right, so then you're concentrating whatever budget cuts would come in a notional deal. They're all coming in social welfare programs, education spending, and kind of everything else that's a small share of federal government spending.
Thanks for that call, Joni. We're talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, political scientist, expert on public affairs, looking at the fast-approaching federal debt limit, the ongoing partisan debate surrounding it, and the potential economic consequences if no agreement can be reached in time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of this? Do you want to see spending cuts? Do you want to see some tax increases? Do you think the debt ceiling should be off the table, not subject to negotiation in the first place? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, looking at the ongoing political negotiations to increase the federal debt ceiling and what happens if that doesn't happen soon. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Mark, before we go back to our callers, there are concerns that the people who rate investment worthiness of different institutions, including countries like the United States, even if there's not a total collapse here, they might look and say, okay, we're putting these investments, these debts at risk. Does this make the U.S. less trustworthy?
Right. Yeah, look, so investors hate nothing more than uncertainty, right, in global finance. And so if every time we get near this debt ceiling now, given our domestic politics, it looks like we're going to have these episodes of walking up to the brink of default, you can imagine that credit ratings for the country would go down relative to other investments which are seen as more safe. And again, that in, on some way, level, that's not an actual assessment of like the U.S.'s ability to borrow. We can borrow in more, you know, amount-wise and ease more than any other country in the global financial system. But we're one of only two countries that has one of these debt ceiling laws that runs us up to this this nominal limit. So we could abolish the debt ceiling law and never markets wouldn't worry about the U.S. defaulting. We've never defaulted in our history, et cetera. But as long as we have that law and you're going to get up to a cap every year or every 2 years, then there's some concern you go over it. And you could imagine that would ultimately affect our credit rating relative to Germany or France or Canada or other countries where that's not going to happen.
Let's go back to our callers now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi, I had a question regarding Biden invoking the 14th Amendment to address the debt. And as you just stated, obviously, this would go to the Supreme Court. And with this Supreme Court, wouldn't that open the door to other aspects of the 14th Amendment being undermined, namely like the Equal Protection Clause and what that implies then for the federal government's ability to make sure that states are being impartial in how they deal with people?
So I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly the answer to that question. My sense is the case as it would make its way through the court system would be specifically about Section 4 of the 14th Amendment and the validity of the public debt. So conceivably, you could have legal cases that were more broadly about the 14th Amendment as a whole. But what I've seen so far in discussion of the types of things that would make its way up to the court is specifically the clause that says the validity of the public debt shall not be questioned.
Thanks for raising that question. Laura is with us now in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Hi. A couple questions, actually.
Oh.
I had heard...
We got a bad connection there, Laura. I'm sorry. Laura, our producer says, was wondering about the debt ceiling being raised under the Trump administration. I assume it came up a couple few times over that 4 years.
Yes. And, you know, again, it's sort of politically predictable in many ways that when the same party controls Congress and the presidency, you don't get these fights. Right. And you don't get these public debates about we're spending too much or that the deficit and the debt are too high. So you get this when you have divided government. right? And this is one of the perils of our presidential political system, where you have competing claims to legitimacy. And so you have a Democrat in the White House and you have Republicans controlling the House of Representatives, both elected in national elections, both saying they have mandates from the people to, you know, spend or not spend or raise taxes or cut spending. And so you tend to only get this type of brinksmanship when you have divided government. But again, what's new about this current fight and the 2011 fight in the Obama administration is, you know, what seemed to be really credible commitments to actually follow through with a default from the Republican Party. And that's something that is actually very different, that we would put the full faith and credit of the United States government at risk over political differences about taxes and spending.
Thanks for that call. Phyllis is on the line now in Clark County. Phyllis, hello.
Hi. Yes, I had a similar concern. Janet Yellen was being attacked by a politician this morning, a Republican politician, who was saying that she wasn't telling the truth and she didn't know her business. Yet it seems as though they believed her when they were dealing with Trump's deficit issues. I'm just wondering why that happened, that she was seen as reliable back then and not now.
Phyllis, thanks. She was in a different position at that point, but Mark, your thoughts.
Yeah, so, you know, she was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the central bank, in 2018. So she was nominated by the president and approved by the Senate and then sort of independent central bank head. So was more insulated from politics. Now she's part of a Democratic presidential administration as the Treasury Secretary. I'm not sure exactly what the caller was referring to, but, you know, she's been asked several times about, are you planning for what's going to happen with default and questions of that variety. And my sense with that is the answer is yes. And the Treasury Secretary and the president are having very clear conversations about what would happen. But she's also not going to get up in front of the microphone and candidly admit these are the three steps that we're going to take if it actually follows through next Thursday.
Thanks, Phyllis, for the call. Mike is with us now in Spring Green. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question regarding, I guess, discretionary spending. If a budget deal isn't passed, is the ag program, the farm bill, part of discretionary spending, and would that be in jeopardy if a budget isn't agreed on?
I mean, with the budgetary process, you know, the Congress very often, as Rob mentioned earlier, doesn't meet deadlines for the budgetary process, and then we get continuing resolutions which keep spending for a temporary period of time at a certain level. So, you know, assuming that there is some resolution to this debt ceiling brinksmanship, then I think you get into that prolonged budget process, in which case programs like that are not going to be zeroed out. But we may have future budget showdowns and temporary shutdowns like we've had very frequently in the past under divided government.
But that farm bill wouldn't, or the farm funding part of the government isn't untouchable in the categories you laid out there. It's not in those Medicare and Social Security. It's not defense spending.
Right. No, I mean, in theory, nothing is untouchable. Mm-hmm. But it's just sort of the public statements of the Republicans that the cuts are all going to have to come from the non-discretionary spending. But it's not a dedicated endowment fund like Social Security and like Medicare. What are called as entitlements.
Thanks for that call. Mark, just a minute for a big question here. You'd think, hey, divided government, Democrats in one branch, Republicans another. Hey, that's a time for compromise. As we've learned here in Wisconsin, it doesn't always play out that way.
No. And, you know, when you have a set of political institutions where both parties can get elected, right? And we have that again in Wisconsin as well, where the Democrats tend to do very well recently in the statewide elections and not in the legislative elections. You get both parties willing to dig in more because they feel like they don't have to compromise to get reelected. So if Kevin McCarthy is very worried about retaining his speakership because of divisions within the Republican caucus, but he's not facing the electorate for control of the House for another year and a half right now.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back.
That's Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was with us today for a look at the ongoing negotiations to increase the federal debt limit and what happens if Republicans and Democrats don't reach an agreement. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, let's go fishing. It's a great time of year to get out on the water. Kate gets some advice for beginners and for longtime anglers, and you can join in and share your own experiences. You can get started right now with your questions at ideas@WPR.org. Send an email, ideas@WPR.org. Join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30. The other day, we invited you to share your stories of summer road trips. Great ones from the past, trips you have in the works. A lot of you called in with great stories. Here are some more you shared on email. Sumner writes, my most memorable road trip was by bicycle up the California coast on Highway 1 from Santa Barbara to Berkeley. It was 1970 when I was a high schooler. Back during the hippie days, Sumner says, people would allow me to camp out in their backyards and feed me as I biked from town to town. I'll never forget it. Jessica writes, just got back from Gulf Shores with my kids and sister and her kids. We visited city parks for picnics on the way, made pit stops in Mississippi, Memphis, wrapped up the trip with a stop at Six Flags. Before coming home yesterday, I drove all of the miles and I'm exhausted yet. And Jessica says, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. Thanks so much for those stories. Keep them coming. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.